assessing the situation right now, and it's unclear to PetroStar at this time the extent of the damage.
A fire shuts down the Valdez refinery. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 29th of December. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, a hard-working group of Bethel volunteers celebrates a new building.
I think it's probably one of the most amazing things that has happened for the local search and rescue, that it probably has happened in many years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
A large fire has shut down the PetroStar refinery in Valdez. The fire was extinguished early this morning. 32 firefighters responded from the company, from the city, and from Trans-Alaska pipeline operator Alyeska. Sherry Pierce is the information officer with the city. She says flames and smoke were visible from town about 6 miles away.
We had terrible weather conditions last night. It was 10 degrees, and we were having wind gusts of 50 miles per hour and blowing snow. And they extinguished the fire completely within 2 hours.
Pierce says it may be a few days before the cause of the fire is known. There were no injuries, but two of the main refinery towers, which are used to separate fuels, were badly damaged. Tara Sweeney is vice president of communications for Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, which owns PetroStar. She says the refinery produces about 13,000 barrels of product a day.
Approximately 9,000 barrels per day is processed as jet fuel, 3,000 per day as diesel, and 300 barrels per day as LSR, which is a fuel used to generate electricity by the local utility.
Sweeney says PetroStar supplies less than 10% of the demand at Ted Stevens International Airport. Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage is another customer, but Sweeney says they have other options for fuel. PetroStar also supplies fuel to Interior Alaska. Another Arctic Slope plant in North Pole could take over some of that capacity, but Sweeney says EPA restrictions limit the amount of heating oil and diesel the North Pole plant can produce.
PetroStar has been trucking large volumes of fuel from Valdez up to the interior region of Alaska. And one of the next steps for us is that the company officials for PetroStar plan to seek federal relief to lift those limitations on the North Pole refinery so that it can meet more of the fuel needs for interior Alaska.
PetroStar doesn't know when the Valdez facility will reopen. 22 people are employed there, but Sweeney says their employment won't be affected by the fire. Bethel Search and Rescue has never had a building of its own. But now the all-volunteer organization is moving into their very own building, and for many involved with the organization, it's a momentous occasion. From member station KYUK, Shane Iverson reports.
From the outside, Bethel's newest headquarters blends into its surroundings. It rests just a snowball's throw from Bethel's only highway, but it's tucked away in some of town's oldest alders and in one of the oldest neighborhoods. There, the Crimson Building is inconspicuous and goes unnoticed even by longtime Bethel residents. Much like Bethel Search and Rescue, the construction project has been understated but vital. Earl Samuelson is an Alaska State Trooper pilot. He regularly performs missions with the Volunteer Search and Rescue Squad. He says this new building of theirs is monumental.
But a place where they can call home, I think it's probably one of the most amazing things that has happened for the local search and rescue, that it probably has happened in many years.
Inside, about 24 people are checking out the brand new headquarters. Bethel Search and Rescue President Peter Achak is taking it all in as he darts into a room.
We even got a kitchenette here with a fridge and a sink and a little stove there.
Minutes later, in front of the crowd, contractor Jimmy Gwynn turns over the keys to Achak and the Bethel Search and Rescue team.
Here we go. The set of keys. He's in charge of these things. Don't let him lose them. One goes to Mike right away.
Absolutely. Yep.
Congratulations.
The building is modest in appearances and is mainly a large floor space. Rows of fluorescent lights run down the long ceiling. According to Gwen, the building was made to SAR's specifications.
The building is the newest high-tech, energy-efficient building you can build at a low cost. The size is 40 by 60, two 10 by 10 offices, two 10 by 10 kitchens slash bathrooms, R30 in the walls, Toyota stove.
The new headquarters is basically a fort of insulation, meant to keep heating bills low and maintain enough space for meetings and other events. Since their inception over 30 years ago, Bethel Search and Rescue has saved scores of lives in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and when a rescue becomes a recovery, they have searched countless days in hopes of returning a body to anguished family. But all their work is on their own time, and usually on their own dime. Lifelong Bethel resident Ray Watson says the search and rescue guys are the only chance lost or stranded travelers often have. Watson came to see their new headquarters.
They don't ask for anything in return. All they're about is saving lives and helping the community.
To accomplish that, search and rescue members keep equipment in their own homes. And as Etchak says, just meeting together can become a logistical dilemma.
When it comes time for meetings, we've scrounged for space, you know, any place that we can gather to sit down to have a meeting.
As the crowd dissipates, a few SAR members linger about. The space seems even bigger now. The only objects are a 12-pack of Coke and a few plaques from the Alaska State Troopers and the City of Bethel. With bodies out of the way, Etchak envisions what their new base could look like in the future.
The space in the middle will be like our meeting space, training space here. We can place a map and then plan out our rescue missions that we do.
But how exactly the organization will fill out their new space is still a bit uncertain. The state gave Bethel Search and Rescue just over $200,000 to build the place. That wasn't enough to buy any land, so the city of Bethel is basically donating that. With a one-time appropriation now spent, Search and Rescue is not expecting any new funding.
Bring your own chair. or some, we can ask somebody for a few chairs to get started with, maybe.
Though empty, Etchak says he's been dreaming of a search and rescue headquarters for decades now. But even in his dreams, it didn't look like this.
I hadn't expected we would get something. Our first building would be something close to a high-tech building that we can be proud of, that our group can be proud of and take care of. So, yes, we are very proud. It's a very big day for us.
Search and Rescue plans on using the building to train as well as coordinate rescues, and they believe it will help them to become more efficient at saving lives. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
6 months after Juneau emerged from its energy emergency, the capital city continues to conserve electricity. When avalanches cut the city off from its main source of hydropower in April, Alaska Electric Light and Power, AEL&P, fired up expensive diesel generators to keep the city's lights on. Skyrocketing prices drove electricity use down by a third. After hydropower was restored in June, prices fell and consumption bounced back up, but not all the way up. Juneau's demand for power has remained somewhat diminished. Scott Willis with AEL&P says a mid-December cold snap pushed power consumption above 2007 levels for the first time since April.
It looks like we're still about 8 to 10% lower than last year once we correct for cold weather.
Willis does not know what technologies or behavior shifts are responsible for the long-term reduction in energy use. University of California graduate student and former Juneau resident Wayne Leedy said we'll be conducting surveys to answer that question starting next month. Willis says Juneau should have enough hydropower to get through this winter without turning to diesel generators. He credits reduced demand for electricity and a wet autumn.
October was so wet that kept the lakes full on into the season. So the lakes are high, and our forecast for needing diesel this winter is that we won't need any.
A surge in electricity consumption or a major avalanche along the Snettisham power line could force the capital city to turn to diesel once again. Juneau's power company has hired a firm to use explosives and other measures to protect the transmission line from avalanches. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage prepares to host the Cross Country Ski Championships.
It's amazing to just go out and watch other people do it with such incredible speed and ease. It's almost like a different species out there skiing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska's Statehood Day celebration starts on Friday, January 2nd, with a grand commemorative statehood gala and dinner at the Denina Center. For reservations and tickets, visit AlaskaTurns50.com. The free festivities are Saturday, January 3rd, starting at 3 p.m., featuring a parade of delegates from across Alaska in downtown Anchorage, entertainment at the Denina and Egan Convention Centers, and the Performing Arts Center. Details at AlaskaTurns50.com. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Statehood Celebration Committee.
The top Nordic skiers in the country will be descending on Anchorage this coming weekend for the U.S. Cross Country Championships. About 500 skiers are expected to participate. The events kick off at Kincaid Park with a classic sprint on Saturday morning. John Quinley is the spokesperson for the event. He says the snow is in great shape.
You know, it's going to be cold, probably in the single digits, certainly for the sprint races on Saturday. Which might make it a little bit slower skiing than some folks might hope for, but certainly better than some of the previous winters we've had here, where you could sort of see the leaves through the snow. This is looking good right now.
How important would you say these races are for top college skiers and other Nordic athletes from around the country?
This is sort of the premier event of the year. This is the U.S. National Championships. Talking about skiers moving up into the U.S. ski team for college skiers. A couple of these races count towards NCAA championship points in their effort to qualify for that. And for junior skiers, younger skiers, it's an opportunity to make the competition teams for international competition. So it's this brings out the best skiers in the United States, and Anchorage will host it this year and next year as well. You know, these will be skiers who are prepping and hoping for a position on the United States Olympic team.
You mentioned that you have expecting 500 skiers. Are there any local Alaska names that we could be expecting to see?
Well, there are. Of course, probably the best-known Alaska skier is Keegan Randall, and she will be skiing at least the first three races, the sprint and the two longer races. She won a World Cup competition last year, has been to the Olympics, and expects to go again when the Olympics, Winter Olympics are in Canada. Some of her teammates from Alaska Pacific University, Taz Mannix, and others will be out there. And then a lot of local high school, top high school skiers and UAA students, skiers will be competing as well.
What about spectators? Do you have any idea how many you might be expecting?
I suspect that, certainly Saturday's sprint will bring out several hundred people. It's a chance to see the best skiers in the country, as well as a lot of local talent that will be going head-to-head. The sprints is an easy set of events to watch because from the stadium at Kincaid, you can see most of the race. There's a little section of it which turns up into the trees and the hills for a few hundred meters, but most of it is visible, and the races are fast. They're over within, each heat is maybe going to be 3 or 4 minutes long, and the races are sometimes decided by the length of a ski boot, so they're really exciting to watch.
Are there any long-term benefits to Anchorage skiers for hosting this event?
Well, it's a chance for Anchorage skiers to ski against the best competition in the country and to do it in their own backyard. And it's a chance for younger skiers to really see to have something to aspire to look at older college-age students and beyond and see where training can really take you. And I think it's great to be able to show that off to Anchorage as a pursuit, both for elite racing level and also just to, I think any of us who get out and ski and sort of huff and puff our way around, dozens and dozens of miles of trails in Anchorage, it's amazing to just go out and watch other people do it with such incredible speed and ease. It's almost like a different species out there skiing. You know, you think of yourself slogging up a hill, and then you watch these elite skiers in the nation sort of whip by in about a half a minute, and you just can't believe that they're actually doing the same sport you are. And it's really fun to watch. A little discouraging maybe in some ways, but a lot of fun.
John Quinley is a spokesperson for the U.S. Cross Country Ski Championships, which will kick off at Kincaid Park on Saturday morning. Thank you for joining us, John.
My pleasure.
Juno's Richard and Nora Marks Downhauer have won a 2008 America Book Award for their latest publication, Anushi Lingit Anaika, Russians in Tlingit America, The Battles of Sitka, 1802 and 1804. The Downhauers received the award at ceremonies in Berkeley, California over the weekend. The scholars' work was honored along with this year's other national winners. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, the Downhauers, along with their co-editor, the late Lydia Black, have compiled what is likely the most diverse examination to date of the struggle for control of Southeast Alaska.
You've probably heard the cliché that history is written by the winners, but the history of the Russian colonial experience in Alaska is far more complicated than who won and who lost. Between 1799 and 1805, the Russian-American Company wrested control of Sitka and the Northwest Coast fur trade, but that control was limited, and the company's relationship with the Tlingit was complicated. When the Downhauers published Anushi Lingit Anika in May of this year, scholars gained access for the first time to this story from the Tlingit perspective. Central to the book are extensive transcriptions and translations of recordings made in the mid-20th century of Tlingit elders born in the 1870s who had been given the stories of the battles in Tlingit by their elders. Richard Downhauer says these important sources have been unavailable until now.
The main thing that we do in our work is we only work with the support and the permission of the community. And at that time, the community was still divided as to a very fundamental question of who owns history. You know, and this may seem kind of strange to people, but it's really a profound question. And in this case, is this history belong exclusively to the Tlingits and more particularly to the Kiksadi of Sitka, or there are other people involved? There were white Americans on both sides of the battle. There were Russians. There were Germans. There were, you know, a lot of different people. So that was an issue that had to be resolved, and some of the older generation said, no, we don't want to go public, and also for a very good reason that once peace has been made, you don't talk about a war.
Russian-American history has been principally the Russian story, documented in the letters and instructions of company chief manager Alexander Baranov and in the logs and publications of officers like Yuri Lysianski, whose ship, the Neva, was instrumental in the capture of Sitka in 1804. Parts of the Tlingit oral tradition have emerged previously, but scholarship has been hesitant to embrace that manner of recording history. Downhauer says it turns out that Tlingit elder Sally Hopkins committed a detailed oral tradition to tape that was remarkably consistent with documented history.
What was beautiful to us is the way the two accounts come together. And in some cases, we even have artifacts. There's a place where Sally Hopkins mentioned Baranov gave a medal to one of the Tlingits and put it on his neck. And Lysianski, in his report, says the same thing. He, you know, from on such and such a day it was done, and we still have that in the State Museum in Juneau.
Along with the transcribed Tlingit histories, Anushi Lingit Anika contains a number of previously unpublished letters and documents translated by Russian scholar Lydia Black and scholarly works on topics ranging from archaeology to Tlingit battle armor. The book has the heft and feel of a definitive work about a historical subject, and Downhauer says it's likely that it will remain as the Tlingit record of the battles. Still, as a historian, he admits that there is always more to learn.
Like the Battle of the Alamo, I mean, the Battle of Sitka was probably ultimately a relatively insignificant battle as far as battles go. As far as the future map, I mean, look at the way that it defined the map of North America, with Alaska being becoming Russian territory and then ultimately a part of the United States. And probably if that hadn't happened, it might have become part of Hudson Bay territory and then part of Canada, part of the British Empire. So I think there's a lot of complexity that we're just becoming aware of.
The American Book Awards were established in 1978 by the Before Columbus Foundation to recognize achievement from the entire spectrum of America's diverse literary community. Some previous Alaska winners include Ernestine Hayes for her book Blonde Indian, an Alaska Native Memoir, and Peter Metcalf for Gumboot Determination, a history of the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. won the award in 2005 for his book Crimes Against Nature. Richard Downhauer says he and his wife, Nora, are honored to be among this year's winners, but the recognition will be bittersweet without co-editor Lydia Black, who died in March of 2007 at the age of 81. Downhauer says they relied immeasurably on Black for her Russian language expertise and historical scholarship. He says completing the book without Black was like growing up all of a sudden. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
Scientists are studying an unusual form of life found in some southeast Alaska caves. It's called moon milk, and it's made up of tiny organisms that chew through rock. Researchers say it could provide a view of what life might be like on other planets. And they're focusing on southeast because the region has so much of it. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfield paid a visit to one of Prince of Wales Island's many caves to see moon milk for himself and to learn more.
There's no polite way to get into the narrow entrance of Wingate Cave.
So it sounds like backing in is the best way?
Backing in and coming down, I believe, is the best way to get over this thing. Unless you're small and flexible,
which I am now.
But once I scramble inside, I see that things open up. There's a tall room, a stream underfoot, and a steep passageway reaching up to a higher entrance.
I'm looking at a crack in the side of the wall, and there's a white, almost foamy substance there. It's moon milk. It's part mineral, part bacteria, part who knows what. It's covering part of the side of this wall, almost all the way up to the ceiling.
Moon milk isn't really all that impressive to look at. It sort of reminds me of sprayed-on insulation, or toothpaste, or even curdled cottage cheese. But it's fascinating because it's a mineral feature that's packed full of living organisms. Forest Service geologist Jim Bechtel is fascinated, too.
Moon milk exists throughout the cave, but it's really prominent in these fractures that get up approaching the surface, like we're maybe 35, 40 feet below the forest above us. And all of the formations you see up there are soft, even though they look like stalagmites and stalactites and flowstones. They're moon milk. It's hydrous calcium carbonate formed by bacteriological activity.
Scientists are taking a hard look at what's on the walls of this cave and others on Prince of Wales Island because there's so much of it. This moon milk is dense, a yard deep in some places. Elsewhere around the world, it's often only a thin crust. But why do they care? Because this stuff actually eats rock. It doesn't need light or other plants or animals or any sort of organic material to survive. It's on a hard rock diet. To find out more, I called Penny Boston, a New Mexico-based microbiologist and expert on cave formations who's studying the moon milk in Wingate Cave.
The detailed chemistry and so forth is interesting scientifically, but the real message here is that these guys are chewing their way through bedrock and they're pooping out or reprecipitating in some fashion these unique formations.
Dozens of tiny organisms live in this stuff, including bacteria and fungi. Under a microscope, it looks like filaments woven around finned, rod-shaped crystals. Some of the living components are from the surface or have close relatives above ground. But Boston, who works with the National Cave and Karst Research Institute, says others are more exotic.
In fact, in some of our caves, the closest relatives will be something very exotic like deep-sea hydrothermal vent organisms, or they'll be related to marine organisms.
And some of it, well, doesn't seem to be closely related to anything. Back in Alaska, geologist Jim Baichtal is interested in the role moon milk plays in the forest ecosystem. He knows trees grow taller over cave-pocketed areas. Maybe moon milk is the reason. Just inside Wingate Cave, he points to a foam-filled fissure.
It's completely packed with roots. The roots come right to the base of the moon milk, and just the nodes stick out. And it makes me wonder if there is a relationship between the bacteriological activity releasing nutrients to the trees, making it available to the trees, and also the fact that it's moist all the time. And so maybe the moon milk is the source for the water and the nutrients for this forest that's flourishing above.
Figuring that out might help scientists get a better handle on the health of the forest. Moon milk could also be useful in the study of geology, evolution, and climate change. Scientists are even examining it as they try to predict what life might be like on other planets. That's because it lives in extreme conditions, underground, away from sunlight and conventional food that might exist elsewhere in the solar system. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
The 18-year-old daughter of Governor Sarah Palin has given birth in Alaska to a son. People magazine reports that Bristol Palin gave birth to Tripp Easton Mitchell Johnston on Sunday. He weighed 7 pounds, 4 ounces. Relative Colleen Johnson tells the magazine the baby is fine and that Bristol is also doing well. The father is Levi Johnston, a former hockey player at Wasilla High School. He has said that he and Bristol plan to marry. Palin created a stir in September by announcing the pregnancy as she prepared to accept her nomination for vice president at the Republican National Convention. The governor's office called the birth a private family matter. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to aprn.org, click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page, and be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, John Ryan and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. And by
BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.